Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. The European Union is looking for new cooperation with the Arab world to combat Islamic terrorism. EU foreign ministers met today in Brussels to discuss ways to thwart would-be terrorism attacks. EU Foreign Affairs Chief Federica Mogherini called for closer EU links with Muslim countries. She spoke to reporters just before the meeting.
The threat is not only the one we faced in Paris, but also spreading in many other parts of the world, starting from Muslim countries. And we need to strengthen our way of cooperating together.
On another front, the EU minister said they would appeal a court decision last month that removed the Palestinian Islamist group Hamas from the EU's terrorism blacklist. Yemen's government and Houthi rebels have declared a ceasefire, which appeared to be taking hold in the capital Sana'a after a day of sporadic fighting. Today's violence appeared to start with a Houthi attack on the prime minister's convoy as it left the presidential palace. The prime minister was not hurt. There was fighting today between government and separatist forces in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's military says hundreds of Russian troops crossed the border to help the rebels. The general staff of Ukraine's armed forces claimed they had established control over the disputed Donetsk airport after driving out rebel forces there. The forces were said to have retreated to residential areas of the city of Donetsk. Mali has declared itself Ebola-free. Health Minister Ousmane Kone made the announcement on Sunday, saying there have been no new cases in 42 days, the World Health Organization's time frame for declaring an end to an epidemic. This is VOA News. People in police in the Democratic Republic of Congo used live rounds and tear gas today to break up protests against a proposed law that could delay national elections. Opponents say the law requiring completion of a national census before elections would allow President Joseph Kabila to stay in office past the end of his term late next year. Police in Kenya today tear gassed a group of school children who were protesting the loss of their playground to a private land developer. Video from Nairobi shows children running in panic after police in riot gear dropped a tear gas canister in front of a large crowd. At least three children were said to be injured in the commotion. Weather-related problems have hit at least two of Africa's nations. News reports say people in the flood-ravaged Nsanje district of Malawi are getting aid from the government. Floods there have left dozens of people dead, more than 200,000 homeless. Meanwhile, the AP quoted officials in Madagascar as saying at least 14 people there have been killed as a result of a tropical storm that hit the island Friday and Saturday. Officials in Cameroon say Boko Haram militants kidnapped at least 60 people Sunday in a cross-border raid from Nigeria. The officials say several people who tried to stop the militants were killed. About 80 houses were said to have been burned to the ground. Reuters quotes a Cameroon Defense Ministry spokesman as saying 24 of the hostages have been released. The richest 1% of people in the world will have the majority of wealth on the entire planet next year, according to Oxfam. The most affluent share of global wealth climbed to 48% in 2014 and will likely pass 50% in 2016. That report released today ahead of the annual World Economic Forum meeting this week in Davos, Switzerland. Indonesian investigators say they have found no evidence of terrorism in last month's Air Asia plane crash. The head of a 10-member investigative team from the National Transportation Safety Committee told Reuters news agency today that no threats were found in the cockpit voice recordings on the plane. A human rights group says asylum seekers at a detention center in Papua New Guinea are protesting a plan by Australia to permanently settle them on the island. The Refugee Action Committee says detainees at the Manus Island Detention Center have barricaded themselves inside of the facility and are preventing the delivery of food. They say if they are settled in PNG, they will be attacked by locals and not be able to find employment. Australia's immigration minister says his government is working with the PNG government to try to resolve that dispute. Asia Pacific stock markets closed mostly lower today. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization says 16 million people under the age of 70 are dying prematurely every year from non-communicable diseases. A new report is calling for action to reduce these largely preventable deaths.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, officials in Cameroon say Boko Haram militants kidnapped at least 60 people, including children, yesterday in a cross-border raid from Nigeria. And a World Health Organization official says 488 health workers have died in the West Africa Ebola outbreak.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the Horn of Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, officials in Cameroon say Boko Haram militants kidnapped at least 60 people, including children, yesterday in a cross-border raid from Nigeria. The officials say several people who tried to stop the militants were killed and about 80 homes were burned to the ground. However, the French news agency quotes sources today as saying that about 20 of the hostages were released by the militants while they were being pursued by Cameroon's army. Also, a suicide bombing was reported yesterday in the northern Nigerian city of Patiskum. Four people were reported killed and at least 25 wounded. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but Boko Haram is suspected in the attack.
The World Health Organization says 16 million people under the age of 70 are dying prematurely every year from non-communicable diseases. A new report is calling for action to reduce this largely preventable deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Non-communicable diseases are the leading cause of death worldwide, accounting for 63% of all yearly deaths. The World Health Organization reports millions of people are dying prematurely from four major types of illnesses: heart and lung diseases, stroke, cancer, and diabetes. WHO cites tobacco use, the harmful use of alcohol, unhealthy diets, and physical inactivity as the four major risk factors, and notes embracing healthier lifestyles can significantly reduce these premature deaths. The lead author of the report, Shanti Mendes, is WHO coordinator for chronic diseases prevention and management. She calls non-communicable diseases a slow-motion public health disaster.
We are losing 16 million people every year in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, not in their 80s and 90s. And we are losing 38 million from NCDs overall every year. Out of the 16 million people who die under the age of 70, who are in their productive years, 82% are in low and middle income countries, which don't have the capacity to really address them.
In 2013, the World Health Assembly approved a global action plan that aims to reduce the number of premature deaths from non-communicable diseases by one quarter by 2025. The plan includes 9 voluntary global targets to tackle key risk factors. The report describes inroads being made by several countries that are implementing some of these strategies. For example, it notes smoking rates in Turkey have declined by 13% since the government increased the size of health warnings on tobacco products and increased taxes. While such progress is encouraging, WHO finds most countries are not on track to meet the 2025 goal. Dr. Mendes says many lives could be saved if countries implement a few low-cost strategies. These include a ban on all forms of tobacco advertising, replacing trans fats with polyunsaturated fats, restricting or banning alcohol advertising, and promoting healthy diets and physical activity. She tells VOA another serious problem that must be tackled is obesity in young children. She says 42 million children children under age 5 are overweight and 5 million are obese. She says this is frightening because behaviors that are learned at a very young age are set for life.
Obesity contributes to so many comorbidities. What do I mean that? What I mean by that? If you're obese, you are more prone to develop high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, arthritic complaints, cancer, among other diseases. So you are set to develop chronic diseases in later life. What is really, again, alarming is in the last couple of years, the rise in obesity is highest in some African countries. The actual levels may be low now, but the rising trend is remarkable in those countries.
The World Health Organization says a small investment equal to $1 to $3 per person per year could dramatically reduce illness and death from NCDs. Globally, this amounts to $11.2 billion a year. That may sound like a lot until it is compared with the cost of doing business as usual in low- and middle-income countries. The WHO estimates from 2011 to 2025, cumulative economic losses in those countries due to NCDs will amount to $7 trillion. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Children in Guinea start the school year today after a five-month delay due to Ebola. Liberia plans to reopen schools next month. It's a sign of progress as those two countries turn the tide against the epidemic, but not everyone is sure the countries are ready. VOA's Anne Look has the story with reporting by Karim Kamara in Conakry and Prince Collins in Monrovia.
Samson Wese's kids ask him every day.
Every day to be, Papa, when will we return to school?
He welcomes the Liberian government's decision to reopen schools in February. Authorities shut them back in July as Ebola cases surged.
My kids been sitting home and doing nothing, playing, running here and there, and nothing like education as well been going on. The more the children sit home, the more they get dull.
Authorities say schools will have all the necessary safety measures, like thermometers and chlorine for hand washing. But some parents in Liberia say they may keep their kids home a while longer. Mother Christine Thomas says she wants the World Health Organization to declare Liberia Ebola-free first.
So my fear here is if the children go to school and they, you know, come down with Ebola, it would not be too good for the parents who will be feeling bad. So we're hoping and praying that there will be a little bit of delay in this in the opening of school.
In Guinea, teachers express the same concern. They worry about how to limit contact in what are often overcrowded schoolhouses. Teacher Amadou Diallo says the children play together during recess, and no one can stop them from doing that. The students also share food. He says he thinks reopening schools is a risky decision. Ebola is transmitted via contact with a sick person's bodily fluids. Throughout the epidemic, public health experts have downplayed the risk of contagion through casual contact. Teachers in Guinea told VOA that they, along with about 80,000 of their colleagues, have been trained on Ebola. Civil society groups had threatened to protest unless the schools reopened Monday. Now those civil society groups say they will go out and monitor schools to make sure there are hand-washing stations and that kids' temperatures are being taken daily and recorded. Fever is an early symptom of Ebola. Schools were only shut for 5 months in Guinea and Liberia, but the challenges are not over. Fear could lead to dropouts. School funding has been diverted to Ebola. In Sierra Leone, where schools remain closed, UNICEF Chief of Education Wangani Grace Nkomataula says teenage pregnancy is up. UNICEF is investigating reports of increased child labor.
The impact of the virus on the education system could be something that really reverses the gains that Sierra Leone has made over the years.
Liberia and Sierra Leone have been using radio and television to broadcast at-home lessons in the interim. But it's no substitute for a classroom, and not all children have had access. Taulo says whenever schools do reopen in Sierra Leone, teachers may need to work evening hours or hold weekend and holiday classes to help kids catch up. Anne Look, VOA News, Lagos.
A World Health Organization official says 488 health workers have died in the West Africa Ebola outbreak. Local media report WHO representative Dr. Georges Ki-Zerbo made this statement in Accra, Ghana, at a meeting of the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. He says 221 health workers died in Sierra Leone, 178 in Liberia, and 89 in Guinea. ECOWAS is planning to establish rapid response teams at national and local levels to help contain the Ebola epidemic. The latest official figures show there have been more than 21,000 cases of Ebola in West Africa and more than 8,600 deaths.
Mali announced yesterday that it was Ebola-free. There have been no new cases in 42 days. In all, six people died from Ebola in Mali. And the World Health Organization has good news regarding the three hardest-hit countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. It says the number of new cases over the past 5 months is showing its first decline since the start of the epidemic a year ago. However, the International Emergency Response Organization, International Rescue Committee, IRC, warns caution should be used when interpreting what the declining numbers really mean. Emmanuel Darcourt is the senior health director for IRC. He spoke with me about the latest Ebola rates in each of the heavily affected West African countries.
Well, first of all, I think we have to be very careful in interpreting the numbers, and I think the story is different in every one of those countries. Our information and our interpretation of the numbers, based both on field realities and what we hear from other sources, is that the declines are definitely real in Liberia. They're probably real in Sierra Leone, and they're very uncertain as to their meaning in Guinea. So in terms of what the causes are of the reductions in Liberia, where we're very confident that this is a real reduction, it's primarily, in our view, because people, communities, have really gotten an understanding of the disease and decided to take action. And we see that at every level, at the level of the government, but also at the level of local administration and even at the level of villages. And we think that the similar dynamic is occurring in Sierra Leone.
What would you say the story is in Guinea?
So in Guinea, and I should be honest that the IRC doesn't have a presence there at the moment, though we worked there for 19 years, so have a lot of contacts in the country and a good understanding, I feel, of the underlying dynamic. But in Guinea, there's real questions about how real those numbers are. You'll have to remember that the whole epidemic in the three countries really flared up because the international community and WHO and Doctors Without Borders declared the epidemic over because there were no infections for 21 days. And in fact, what was happening was not that there weren't cases, but that they were being hidden. And the same dynamic that caused that epidemic to burn underground without being reported is still in place, meaning that people still do not trust the government. They still don't trust international organizations. And so we need a lot more confidence in the numbers before we really believe that there's actually a reduction.
What would you say then, based on this information, is the biggest or some of the biggest lessons learned in fighting this largest outbreak of Ebola?
One of the biggest lessons for Ebola is that you can't separate politics and public health. It's very important for public health professionals to understand that issues such as trust in the system, trust in the government, trust in the public health services is a vital element of our work. If we persist in looking at technical fixes, for example, of saying we're just going to do more training so that people know how to do surveillance, we're missing the key element of do people believe what they're being told on the radio or by government officials. And we really have to work on that. And obviously, we can't work on it just when there's an epidemic. We have to be able to view that as part of our work and part of the thing that we measure, which is how much trust there is in the system. And then we have to go and do things that build trust in the system. To some extent, we know what those things are. They're not easy to do, but they're also not impossible.
What would be an example of a measure that needs to be put into place going forward?
First of all, there needs to be regular payment of salaries to frontline health officials, because in all three countries, one of the reasons for the lack of trust is that clinic workers, public health officials aren't paid regularly, and they find other ways to earn a living. And those ways sometimes include corruption, sometimes they include working on the side or moonlighting, and those ways all end up undermining the public trust. So it's really essential that key people in the public health infrastructure, and that includes nurses and managing officials, have a regular salary that allows them to live and that allows them to focus on their job.
Also, what role do people need to play, people living in these communities that were affected? What do they need to do going forward in terms of maybe changing their lifestyle?
That's a tough question because it's different in different places. I think many of the lifestyle changes that Ebola has forced, such as burial practices, for example, and caring for sick people, are not inherently public health risks. They're only really risks during an Ebola epidemic. So I think it's important that we not offer sweeping changes when really those aren't justified in the long term. I think the key element, to be frank, is less the change in people's behaviors than an increase in trust between people and the government. And obviously, the government and international agencies can do a lot to increase that trust. At the same time, we have to recognize that some of the problems and some of the lack of trust is caused not just by government actions, but also a tendency to believe conspiracies and also the kind of rise of what you might call bad leaders, people who stoke their neighbors and their communities towards violence. And I think it's important for people to be wise about who they listen to and who they allow to represent them.
That was Emmanuel Darcourt, Senior Health Director for the IRC. He spoke with me from New York City. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhi, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Officials in Cameroon say Boko Haram militants kidnapped at least 60 people, including children, yesterday in a cross-border raid from Nigeria. And a World Health Organization official says 488 health workers have died in the West Africa Ebola outbreak. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Security forces in the DRC capital, Kinshasa, used tear gas and fired live rounds today to disperse thousands of protesters. Reuters says police used the gas when protesters began throwing rocks. Demonstrators took to the streets to try to block possible election reforms that opposition parties say could delay elections until at least next year. A proposed law calls for a national consensus to be conducted prior to the next elections. The bill was approved by the lower house of parliament over the weekend, and the Senate is now scheduled to take up the matter.
And in Zambia, voters go to the polls tomorrow to choose a new president. 11 candidates are on the ballot, but the leading candidates are Edgar Lungu of the ruling Patriotic Front Party and Hakainde Hichilema of the United Party for National Development. The winner of the presidential election will replace Michael Sata, who died in October after a long illness.
The Libyan National Army says parts of Benghazi were hit by heavy mortar and rocket fire this evening. It says the militant group Ansar al-Sharia is believed responsible for the attack. The areas of Benghazi affected are Leyte, Bouatini, and Shibna. The attack may be in response to the Libyan army announcing a partial ceasefire over the weekend. The announcement came 2 days after militias in control of the capital, Tripoli, announced a unilateral truce. The Army says it would abide by a ceasefire, but will continue to pursue terrorists in Benghazi and Derna.
In the last 6 months, the price of oil has fallen by nearly 60%, providing relief for consumers, but causing a huge shakeup in the industry. High-cost drilling projects, such as shale extraction in North America, are seen as vulnerable. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, rival producers are battling to control the oil market with accusations that it is being driven by geopolitics.
Since 2007, U.S. crude oil production in the United States has nearly doubled, thanks mainly to new technologies used in the extraction of shale oil. The recent rapid fall in the price of oil is a result of simple supply and demand, says market analyst Dominic Haywood of Energy Aspects.
Rising U.S. production, especially in 2014 from the shale producers, production grew by about 1 million barrels a day year on year.
A plunging price would normally prompt the producers' cartel, OPEC, to slash production in order to boost the price. Instead, OPEC opted in November to keep its daily production quota at 30 million barrels per day. The aim is to flush out high-cost oil producers who rely on a soaring oil price to fund their operations, says Haywood.
OPEC are a low-cost producer, and as a low-cost producer in a falling price environment, you should not be the one that cuts production. It should be the high-cost producers. And there's various high-cost producers out there. The US shale producers are one contingent of that group.
Speaking Tuesday, the United Arab Emirates Energy Minister Suhail Al-Mazrueh said rising North American shale oil output was unsustainable and needed to be curbed.
We are telling the market that, and the other producers, that they need to be rational. They need to be like OPEC. They need to look at the growth in the international market.
With more oil producers entering the industry in recent years, OPEC is battling to retain control of the market, says analyst Abhishek Deshpande of investment bank Natixis.
They really are trying to test the mettle of the other non-OPEC producers here, such as US and Russia, which are producing almost the same amount of oil as Saudi Arabia.
Oil giant BP announced 300 job cuts in its North Sea operations Thursday. In the United States, the number of new shale drilling projects has declined. Analysts say extraction projects in Canada's tar sands are particularly vulnerable to the falling oil price.
Lots of these projects were modelled and sanctioned on an oil price of between $90 and $110 a barrel. So the economics are no longer what they were.
Major oil producer Iran based its government budget on oil prices of $100 a barrel. President Hassan Rouhani said Tuesday that Iran would withstand the economic pain of falling prices and appeared to accuse longtime rival Saudi Arabia of plotting against Tehran. He said those who have planned the oil price reduction against some countries should know that they will regret it. Analysts predict the oil price is unlikely to rise over the coming year, creating a financial headache for some producers, but relief for many consumers. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
If you come into contact with the bodily fluids of a person infected with Ebola, you must wash with soap and water immediately. I'm Dr. Conde Greaves. The Ebola virus is only present in the blood, feces, vomit, breast milk, sweat, and semen of people who are seriously ill. The virus must get into your body to infect you. Do not touch your eyes, nose, or mouth, and cover any cuts on the skin. If you are caring for someone who has Ebola, do not handle bedding, towels, or clothes that may be soiled with bodily fluids without gloves. Avoid sexual activity with male survivors of Ebola. Men carry the virus in semen for up to 90 days. Ebola cannot survive for long outside the body. Sunlight, heat, Clorox, and alcohol will kill the virus. Know the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Officials in Cameroon say Boko Haram militants kidnapped at least 60 people, including children, yesterday in a cross-border raid from Nigeria. And the World Health Organization says 488 health workers have died in the West Africa Ebola outbreak. Coming up, we'll have music from the Horn of Africa and in our feature segment honoring Dr. Martin Luther King holiday today. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. And happy Monday, Sonny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sonny, I understand you're kicking off today with Africa Cup of Nations football.
Nations Cup fever, Kim. It's heating up. Senegal beat Ghana Monday 2-1 in the opening match for both teams at the 30th Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Equatorial Guinea. The hero for the Lions of Teranga from Senegal was substitute Moussa Sow. He came off the bench in Mongomo and scored the game-winning goal for Senegal in the 94th minute. Andre Dede Ayew, the son of Ghanaian football great Abedi Pele, had given the Black Stars of Ghana a 1-0 lead on a penalty shot in the 14th minute. Mame Birim Diouf equalized for Senegal in the 58th minute on a header from very close range. The game appeared headed for a 1-1 draw before the heroics from Sow, who came off the bench in the 79th minute. Once again, the final from Mongomo, Senegal 2, Ghana 1. The Senegalese are bidding for their first ever Nations Cup championship. Their best previous performance was in 2002, when they finished second behind Cameroon in Mali. Our VOA football fans will remember that same year, the Lions of Teranga from Senegal advanced to the quarterfinals at the FIFA World Cup, co-hosted by Japan and South Korea. Meanwhile, Ghana's captain, Asamoah John, did not play against Senegal after suffering from what's being described as a mild bout of malaria. The Ghana Football Association says John was admitted to a hospital in Mongomo on Saturday evening and released on Sunday morning. John reportedly is responding to treatment, but his status for the remainder of the Nations Cup is not clear. In Monday's second Nations Cup match in Mongomo, Algeria is playing South Africa.
Wild animals and fruit bats can carry the Ebola virus. Avoid them or wear protective clothing. My name is Gareth Bale. Together, we can beat Ebola. VOA!
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
And if you check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page today, Monday, you'll see me wearing a South African football jersey. The jersey was a gift from our Johannesburg-based Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, when I visited South Africa for the 2010 FIFA World Cup. Meanwhile, Mark reports both of Sunday's Nations Cup matches ended in draws.
Second-half goals by Ali Monser and Almeida Ramos saw Tunisia and Cape Verde Islands draw 1-1 in Ebebiyin on Sunday. Earlier on in the other group B tie, Given Singuloma scored in the first half, while Yannick Bolaise replied in the second half as Zambia and the Democratic Republic of Congo also drew 1-1. In Malabo, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, reckons the tournament is off to a good start. CAF Secretary-General Hicham El Almrani explains.
Yes, so far very, very satisfied and honestly a bit beyond expectation, because 50 days seemed as an impossible challenge, but we didn't really have a choice. But we were amazed by the support we got from the local organizing committee and the head of state himself, and all the teams work very hard to ensure that we do have four sites operating, pitches installed, hotels made, security guaranteed, and all those key requirements for a large-scale tournament. So, as you have seen yesterday, the start was good, with a full house, a lot of people, a good pitch, good matches, good football, and finally, we talked about football, which was good after all this time. So far, yes, we are okay with the start.
That was Hicham El Amrani, the Confederation of African Football Secretary General, speaking in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea.
Because this is Africa. For Africa.
I'm very excited.
Because this is Africa. Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
The 30th Africa Cup of Nations officially kicked off on Saturday, as we hear now from the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot, on the spot at Ayemi.
Good evening, Africa. The 2015 Africa Cup of Nations kicked off in Equatorial Guinea on Saturday. The 30th edition of the two-yearly African football extravaganza started with two matches in the port city of Bata. Equatorial Guinea took over as Nations Cup host from Morocco, which was stripped of the hosting rights in October when it asked for a postponement over Ebola fears. 16 teams are participating in the three-week tournament that will run through February 8th. In the opening game, host Equatorial Guinea was denied victory by Congo-Brazzaville after both played 1-1. A sellout crowd of 35,000 turned out for the Group A game. The hosts, who had just 2 months to prepare after being catapulted into the 16-team finals, missed a potentially famous win as they gave up a late goal. Equatorial Guinea opened scoring in the 17th minute through English-based captain Emilio Unsue. But the host allowed Congo to dominate the last 20 minutes of the game, and the inevitable equalizer followed 3 minutes from the end. It was a heartbreaking reversal for an overcapacity crowd who jammed the stairwells and aisle of the stands at the 35,000 capacity stadium after many had broken through a gate leading into the stadium. Equatorial Guinea's new coach Esteban Becker had just 2 weeks to prepare the national team for the game. Former Spanish international Andoni Goycochea was replaced by the Argentine-born Becker, who was coach of Equatorial Guinea's women's team. Equatorial Guinea remains in battle for its next match on Wednesday against Burkina Faso, which finished runner-up at the last Nations Cup, but lost its opening game 2-0 to Gabon on Saturday. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and Malik Evouna were on targets, as Gabon beat Burkina Faso with a goal in each half. Borussia Dortmund striker Aubameyang confirmed his potential to become the next African superstar with a cool finish after 90 minutes, and Evouna headed home just under 20 minutes from time to secure a hard-fought win. And President Teodoro Obiang Nguema of the Central African Nation of Equatorial Guinea said on Saturday that his country was proud to host the Africa Cup of Nations, quote, despite criticism from our enemies, unquote. Speaking at the opening ceremony, President Nguema said Equatorial Guinea warmly welcomes the sporting youth of Africa and modestly offers its contribution and its hospitality. The president's speech was loudly applauded by the home fans, who filled the Estadio do Bata, where the Nzalang National, as the country's national team is known, were held to a 1-1 draw by Congo. The home fans then gave a rousing rendition of the country's national anthem prior to the match, which was attended by the president of Gabon, Congo-Brazzaville, Togo, Mali, and the Central African Republic. Equatorial Guinea was only named as host in November 2014, after original host Morocco stepped down due to fears over the spread of Ebola as the virus ravages parts of West Africa. As President Nguema was beating his chest over the hosting of the Nations Cup, Congo coach Claude Roy was criticizing the tournament organizers. The Congolese team spent more than 1 hour fighting through traffic to reach the stadium for the tournament's opening match.
When we are leaving every training, the bus, to go to the stadium, it takes 12 minutes. Today, with 40 degrees Celsius in the bus, no more AC, it took 65 minutes. They put us in the crowd, in the big traffic jam. Everybody was smiling, the policeman. Maybe it's not only an excuse, but if our beginning in the game was so poor, it's also a reason the high-level competition is playing on details. And if the CAF doesn't understand that they have to protect the teams to arrive from the hotel to the stadium, they have to change. Because it's not possible to do that like that. It's not possible for the players to disrespect the players like that. 65 minutes for 12 minutes, usually. I called from the bus Anthony Bafoué, who is the coordinator. He was so furious, you know. And it seems that the same thing happened also to Burkina. That means we can understand that everybody wants to see the Guinea Equatorial because they save the competition. They're fantastic people who save the competition, but we cannot admit everything for that.
Leroy previously complained about hotel and training conditions. Congo went behind to a 17th-minute goal in a sluggish start, but later took control of the match to force a late equalizer. Leroy is coaching at your record 8th Africa Cup of Nations.
Thanks, Shagun. That's the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot, on the spot at Adeyemi. If you're just tuning in to the Voice of America, Senegal beat Ghana Monday 2-1 in the opening match for both teams at the 30th Nations Cup tournament. The game was played in Mongomo, Equatorial Guinea. Substitute Moussa Sow scored the game winner for Senegal in the 94th minute. In Monday's second match in Mongomo, Algeria will play South Africa. Let's sample some Facebook reaction regarding Senegal's 2-1 victory over Ghana. Joshua Gyamfi, a Ghanaian, writes, "Bad for the Black Stars, but I think Senegal deserved the win. They were obviously the better team." Another Ghanaian, my former VOA colleague, Ernie Akwe-Thompson, writes, "A deserving win for Senegal. Ghana didn't play well at all." And Joshua Zenit, a proud graduate of the University of Port Harcourt in Nigeria, he had a clever one-liner. Joshua writes, "What you sow is what you reap. What you sow is what you reap." Congratulations, Senegal. Congratulations, Moussa Sow. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Americans today observing Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And next, in Nigeria, Boko Haram and the far northeastern town of Baga. But first, some music. Here is Miriam Chimos from the Horn of Africa with Africa Rising.
One step away from the border, you know my people, we can prosper. Somebody bring this boardroom to order. I testify they won't take us under. One right can't taste upon the Bible. Guess the jury know about survival. We beat the firing squad with no rifles. But would you mind, this war is mental. Oh, to a new way, Africa. To a message, it's a tag away. To a no way, Uber Pussy. To a Kapila, now I can need. To Kashimu, Africa. To go to.
survival. Just that you know about survival.
We
the fire.
Miriam Chimos with Africa Rising.
While Americans across the country are observing the federal holiday marking the birthday of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. And the holiday has special meaning for many after the events of recent months in Ferguson, Missouri and New York. Joy Wagner reports.
If he were alive today, what would Martin Luther King say about the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City, both unarmed and killed in confrontations with police, and about the anger and demonstrations that have followed?
Because I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
King's famous I Have a Dream speech, delivered during the 1963 March on Washington, was an iconic event in the struggle to end racial segregation and establish equal rights for all citizens of the United States. Last month, there was another March on Washington. Tens of thousands of demonstrators in the nation's capital called for justice in the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. This demonstration was peaceful. King's niece, Alveda King, whose father, A.D. King, was also a civil rights activist, suggested the violent protest in Ferguson, when a grand jury did not indict the police officer involved in Brown's death, was not the right approach.
Back up.
She called the Ferguson protest slogan, "No justice, no peace," aggressive, and said only peaceful protest can lead to any positive results, recalling the day in 1963 that her own home was bombed.
I remember my dad standing on a car, A.D., and the people wanted to do just what they did in Ferguson. The people were trying to turn over a police car, they wanted to throw rocks, and they were just trying to be very violent. And I remember dad standing on a car, there's a photograph of A.D. standing on a car with a megaphone with a young man. And he says, "Don't riot. Don't be violent. My family and I are okay. Please, go home and pray."
Some critics of the protests suggest the demonstrations have created animosity towards police and may have led to the killing of two New York City police officers, Rafael Ramos and Wenxing Liu. But one of the positive things to emerge is a peaceful discussion about racial discrimination that's taking place in social media.
So when I see the hashtag Black Lives Matter, I believe black lives from conception in the womb until natural death, the sick, the elderly, the young, the old, the educated, those who need things in communities, all black lives and all human lives matter.
In honor of this holiday, parades are organized in many cities and hymns are sung in churches across the country. Americans, including the president and his family, take part in community projects aimed to bring Americans together. Veda King says that this was her uncle's dream, to see this nation peaceful and united. Joy Wagner for Anusha Vetsian, VOA News, Washington.
If your light won't shine, please don't put out mine. Oh.
In Nigeria, it's been nearly 2 weeks since Boko Haram seized the far northeastern town of Baga and began raiding nearby villages. Local officials say militants killed hundreds of civilians and razed entire communities. And look, has the story reported for VOA by Karim Haruna in Maiduguri, where thousands of Baga residents fled.
Baga fisherman Yahya Takakumi spent 4 days running and hiding in the bush after Boko Haram militants seized the town January 3rd. He says, "I have not seen four of my children and my elder brother. Some people said they saw my brother near the village of Davanshata the day after the attack. But I now fear for his life, because only God can say the number of persons that were killed in the Davanshata area." He walked with one of his wives and his other children to the state capital, Maiduguri. Boko Haram seized the town of Baga from Nigerian troops stationed at a multinational military base there. Survivors told VOA that soldiers ran out of ammunition and had to flee for their lives. They said insurgents blocked the roads out of town and then pursued residents fleeing into the bush. Some residents took canoes across Lake Chad or tried to swim. Takakumi says the killing went on for days in surrounding villages. He says scores of people were killed around Lake Chad. He says Boko Haram blocked the boat pass. He says any boat or canoe that came along, they killed the occupants. Several thousand people from the Baga area fled southwest to Maiduguri. At least 7,000 more fled in the other direction, into Chad. The senator for Northern Borno State told VOA he knows of at least 8 other towns or villages around Baga that had also been raided and torched in the past week. Local officials say they do not know the death toll for now. Cell phone communications are cut. Boko Haram controls the area. A Nigerian government spokesman said Friday that security forces backed by airstrikes are battling to get it back. In Maiduguri, the state government has put up displaced Baga residents in newly built teachers' quarters. The federal government says it is providing assistance for 2,000 people there. The local vigilante group, the civilian JTF, keeps watch at the camp and said Friday that they had arrested 3 suspected Boko Haram members hiding among the IDPs. One of them, a 27-year-old named Garba Mohammed, told VOA he took part in the raid on Baga and then fled. He said Boko Haram forced him and 40 other young men to join last year. His face looked ragged and distressed as he spoke. He says Boko Haram rounded them up at a mosque in Baga. Boko Haram threatened to kill them and their families if they didn't come. He says they were drugged at the camp, and then he was forced to kill or be shot by his commander. He says he has killed 6 people. He said he was finally able to escape in the confusion when Boko Haram raided Baga last week. The civilian JTF says it continues to investigate. Human rights activists say Boko Haram has forcibly conscripted hundreds of young men and abducted hundreds of women and girls in the past year. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
We are beginning to see signs that the massive international effort to combat Ebola in West Africa is working. Since September, when President Obama announced a major increase in the U.S. effort and personally encouraged fellow world leaders to do so too, diplomats and doctors, soldiers and supply experts, health workers and humanitarian specialists have worked side by side to turn the tide. Now, according to the World Health Organization, the Ebola case incidence is declined to much lower levels in Liberia and is showing signs of leveling off in Sierra Leone. But much more must be done. This effort will not be complete until there are no more active Ebola cases in Africa. While President Obama's foremost priority is American public health, this necessarily means ending the Ebola outbreak at its source, in Africa. This is why the U.S. Congress recently approved $5.4 billion in emergency funding to fight the Ebola outbreak. The funding will support the work of infection control specialists from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, disaster relief workers from the U.S. Agency for International Development, and health security specialists from the Department of Defense and the State Department, who are working in concert to combat this outbreak. The money supports a wide range of urgent needs, including the acquisition of personal protective equipment, medical and non-medical management of Ebola treatment units, infection control, contact tracing, laboratory capacity, disease surveillance, burial teams, biosecurity and biosafety activities, and the testing and development of new vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics. The U.S. is also focused on identifying innovative approaches to bring the full range of resources to bear against the crisis. We have identified and obtained funding, for example, for a project by the International Atomic Energy Agency that will improve and streamline efforts to diagnose the Ebola virus in a demonstration of one of the many peaceful uses of nuclear technology. The project will provide high-quality training and equipment based on nuclear science to teams of virologists in 11 African countries. They include Cote d'Ivoire, Guinea, Liberia, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Nigeria, Senegal, Sierra Leone, South Africa, and Uganda. This will help these specialists more quickly and safely diagnose Ebola and other emerging diseases, too. The project is one component of a scaled-up international response that is working to end the epidemic and promote long-term health security that will keep us all safe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.